This week, a new year and a growing humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza as Israel continues its military response to the October 7th Hamas massacre.
They don't have enough physical space in the hospital to accommodate the number of patients that are coming. And obviously, when there's a constant stream of people on the edge of death who need life-saving care.
Ukraine ends the year under massive Russian bombardment and uncertainty about continued Western military aid.
Mother Nature over the past year could not have been more clear with all of us.
And 2023, the hottest year on record, as an escalating climate crisis brought catastrophic floods, drought, and deadly wildfires. Join us on The Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington.
The life is not the same. The life stopped at the 7th of October.
A weeping Israeli father visiting the place where his 21-year-old son was killed by Hamas militants at the Nova Music Festival as the sound of explosions echoed from just 5 kilometers away in Gaza.
He was a good boy. Love to dance. Love the life. That's it.
Thousands of young people were partying in the dawn hours of October 7th when Hamas militants fired a barrage of rockets from Gaza and sent fighters across the border to conduct a bloody surprise rampage to towns in southern Israel. 364 festival goers were among the some 1,200 people, including women, children, infants, and elderly, who were killed. It was the deadliest day in the history of the Jewish state, triggering Israel's devastating counteroffensive in Gaza. Since then, Israel has besieged the narrow Gaza Strip and laid much of it to waste as its forces in recent weeks widen an air and ground offensive against Hamas, bombarding cities, towns, and refugee camps across Gaza, killing dozens and causing significant casualties. Gaza's medical system is crumbling. World Health Organization Emergency Medical Team Coordinator Sean Casey and his humanitarian partners visited a number of hospitals where massive numbers of wounded people have been showing up.
There's blood everywhere in these hospitals at the moment. We're seeing almost only trauma cases come through the door, and at a scale that's quite difficult to believe. It's a bloodbath, as we said before. It's carnage.
More than 20,000 people have reportedly been killed by Israeli airstrikes since the start of the war.
There's nowhere actually that's safe in Gaza.
Acknowledging the deaths of civilians is a tragedy. Amid international calls for an immediate ceasefire, Israel says it will take months more to finish its military operations. Israeli Defense Forces spokesperson Peter Lerner.
It's a tragedy, nevertheless, that Hamas brought on us in a surprise attack. They caused the most devastating attack on Israelis in the history of the state of Israel. And that is precisely why the paradigm needs to change. It's precisely why we have no alternative. What would the alternative be? Not protect ourselves and hope Hamas don't do it again, despite them promising to do the 7th of October repeatedly?
Meanwhile, Hamas and smaller militant ally Islamic Jihad both sworn to Israel's destruction during the October 7th massacre. Gunmen took 240 people hostage.
7 of my family members are kidnapped in Gaza. My mother, my sister's husband, and their children, who are 8 and 3 years old. How can you put a price on a 3-year-old girl? We need them back now at any price.
While some were released during a brief ceasefire, more than 100 are still being held in Gaza as their families plead for their release and fear time is running out to bring them back alive.
Yeah, I don't know if he has water, if he sleeps, if he eats.
Alex, a 2-year-old son that every day keep asking, where is daddy?
My kid, I don't want him in a bag. I still have hope. But that hope each day that passes by, much more difficult.
Bring them all back. Bring my mama back.
And as a new year begins, Israelis and Palestinians are thinking about what will happen in Gaza after the war ends. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
As the fighting rages between Israel and Hamas in Gaza and the death toll continues to climb, the international community is increasingly pressing for a ceasefire. But it's not clear who will eventually take control of Gaza and its 2.2 million people, many of whom lived in poverty before the war began. Tamer Abu Sada is a professor of political science at Al-Azhar University in Gaza.
It doesn't seem to me that there is even consensus among the U.S., Israel, and the regional Arab country, the international community on what to do with Gaza after the war. Who's going to be ruling Gaza?
U.S. President Joe Biden has said he would like to see a revitalized Palestinian Authority, or PA, take control in Gaza once the war ends. But according to polls, 80-90% of Palestinians disapprove of the PA and its 88-year-old leader, Mahmoud Abbas. It is seen as corrupt and ineffective in the West Bank territory it already controls and incapable of governing Gaza. Nevertheless, some PA officials say they are prepared to return to Gaza 16 years after Hamas threw them out in a bloody coup. Hussein Sheikh is the Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization.
I say that it is the right of the PLO and the right of the Palestinian Authority to return to the Gaza Strip. Am I going to Mozambique? I'm going to my country and my people. And even if it is destroyed, it is my responsibility. But it must be within the framework of a comprehensive political vision that is supported regionally and internationally.
Palestinian analysts say that 17 years after the last parliamentary elections, Palestinians must elect more qualified leadership who can unite them. Tahani Mustafa is an expert on the Palestinians at the International Crisis Group.
You're having the international community look for an administration that can provide the technocratic levels of governance, like health, education, but misses the entire point of the fact that Palestinians want and need legitimate leaders. They want a leadership that can advocate for them, even if you're talking about on a diplomatic stage here or on a diplomatic level. And that is something that is completely missing in these discussions about the day after.
Egypt recently offered a three-stage peace proposal, starting with a two-week ceasefire and the release of 40 Israeli hostages, then the formation of a Palestinian technocratic government to hold elections, and finally a complete ceasefire in exchange for the release of all Israeli hostages, freedom for all Palestinian prisoners, and a complete Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. The Egyptian proposal leaves Hamas intact, which Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has repeatedly said is unacceptable. Some Israeli analysts say the goal of eliminating Hamas is unrealistic. Michael Milstein is a former army intelligence officer and a professor at Tel Aviv University.
Hamas, first of all, is an idea before an organization, and Hamas won't be vanished, even if thousands of Hamas terrorists and their political leaders will be killed during the war, they will still have dozens of thousands of supporters in Gaza and, of course, in other arenas like the West Bank.
Netanyahu maintains that neither Hamas nor the Palestinian Authority can play a role in the future of Gaza. But he has not laid out a plan for the future of the area, and it is not clear how Gaza will be governed or eventually rebuilt. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Russia unleashed 122 missiles and dozens of drones against Ukrainian targets Friday, killing at least 24 civilians across the country in what an Air Force official said was likely the most massive aerial barrage of the war. 2023 started for Ukraine with a number of successes, but it ended with uncertainty over continued Western aid and a counteroffensive that failed to make a significant breakthrough. For analysis of the mood on the ground and what lies ahead, I spoke with Ukraine war correspondent and author of The War Came to Us, Life and Death in Ukraine, Christopher Miller.
You ended up writing a book talking about the evolution of your experience there as someone who fell in love with the country before Russia's invasion, and a new year is beginning. And for a while there, it seemed hopeful Ukraine was making progress. How do you think things have been going in the past year and how the year is ending for Ukraine and the situation that it's in?
You know, a year ago this time, Ukraine was still riding pretty high, coming off of two successful counteroffensives that saw it take back all of the territory that Russia had occupied in eastern Kharkiv region. And the counteroffensive of that side reclaim the city of Kherson in the south and push Russian forces further toward Crimea in the south of the country there. You know, they were gearing up, the Ukrainians were, for what was anticipated to be a major spring counteroffensive. That counteroffensive got delayed and pushed back further into the summer, and it became a summer and early autumn counteroffensive that unfortunately failed to achieve Ukraine's lofty goals of reclaiming all of its territory that is currently under Russian occupation and pushing Russian forces out beyond the 1991 borders of the country when Ukraine became an independent state and broke away from the Soviet Union. And that was always going to be a long shot, really, to push Russian forces completely out of Ukraine, including the Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea. But there was hope that with all of this Western military assistance, including American Abrams tanks and various other weapons systems given by the British and the Germans, among other countries, that Ukraine would be able to take back a huge swath of territory and maybe even achieve its strategic objective of cutting off what is called the land bridge that exists between Russia and the occupied territories in the south of the country that connect Russia with occupied Crimea. Now, that didn't happen. And so, you know, where we are now is looking at a Ukrainian military that ran into all sorts of troubles on the front line trying to break through what was a really dense and difficult Russian defensive line with layers and layers of countless mines, heavy weaponry being fired at them. The Ukrainians did unfortunately lose thousands, if not tens of thousands, of soldiers, both killed and wounded. They lost a lot of Western military weapon systems and ammunition, of course, was expended in this attempt at a counteroffensive. And now we're going into 2024, looking ahead at what appears to be another very difficult year politically in the United States. Our own issues in Washington are now raising concerning questions about whether Western military assistance and American assistance in particular is going to continue flowing to Ukraine. And should that dry up, that could be disastrous for the military, which is heavily reliant on Western assistance, but American assistance in particular. And that is because we, the Americans, have a large stockpile of weapons and munitions, whereas the Europeans, who are also very supportive of Ukraine, don't have as deep of stocks. So it's a difficult year ahead. Ukraine's going to have some challenges in regarding the ongoing Western assistance. It will have some force issues of its own. It'll probably have to mobilize more men to fight in this war against Russia. And, you know, a year ago, as I began this, you know, saying that it was the Ukrainians riding high, I think this year the Russians are feeling a little bit more comfortable in their position. Mm-hmm. They're deeper entrenched in their positions. They're looking at a United States that is still deeply polarized, questioning its ongoing support of Ukraine. And it's put itself on a war footing and is producing a lot of weapons. And this could be a year where we see the Ukrainians shift to a more defensive posture and the Russians possibly go more on the offensive.
Right. And there could be the potential for Ukraine continuing to move forward at becoming a member of the EU. And of course, they're also hoping to eventually get into the NATO alliance. All of these things are not going to be quick and they have hit some obstacles, but I'm sure they're still hopeful about that at least.
And this isn't to say that everything is doom and gloom for Ukraine. Obviously, this very important decision came down from the European Council on December 15th that Ukraine would be able to open accession talks with the EU. That was a major political victory for Ukraine, for President Volodymyr Zelensky in particular. You know, I was in Kyiv when this decision came down, and many of my Ukrainian friends were jubilant. You know, it was a moment of levity and high spirits, you know, after months of seeing this counteroffensive struggle. This was, for many Ukrainians, a struggle that was, you know, 10 years since the Euromaidan revolution in 2013 and 14, and even for many well beyond that, who dreamed of becoming a more westernized, democratic, and member of the European Union since independence. So that was a high point. And there certainly are other things that have happened and that are underway in Ukraine related to reforms and the democratization of society, even amid martial law, that I think are bright spots.
Is there one point in particular in the past year that really stood out to you as one of the most difficult? I'm thinking the blowing up of Kakhovka Dam, but from your perspective as someone who lives in Ukraine, is there one particular event that stands out the most?
You know, if I can name maybe a couple, one for me personally was the destruction of the eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut, which is where, as you mentioned, I wrote a book about Ukraine and the war, and Bakhmut was a place that I lived for 2 years and made a lot of friends. And, you know, it was a city, unfortunately, that was destroyed over months and months of of heavy fighting between Ukrainian and Russian forces, and the Russians ended up occupying it in May. And that was a big blow, not only for me and the 70,000 people who lived in that city and called that home, but Bakhmut was a rallying cry for Ukrainians. And, you know, to lose it, it did deal a moral blow to Kyiv. The Kakhovka Dam explosion, certainly, like you mentioned, was devastating. You know, it really made life even more difficult and miserable for those people living on the Dnieper River in the south, flooded huge swaths of an area of southern Ukraine. And so people had to not only worry about bombs and artillery, but also floods and, you know, their water source drying up. And that was a particularly difficult moment, no doubt. I think the third, I would just, you know, reiterate again, the counteroffensive and that not going as planned, that was certainly a blow to the Ukrainians. But I also think in that they learned a lot. And there is some success that I think we can take away from that. First of all, while it didn't achieve the ground objectives in taking territory back, the Ukrainians did manage to use drones and some of the longer range weaponry that they have very effectively in targeting Russia's Black Sea fleet and military bases in Crimea. They destroyed several Russian Black Sea vessels and warships this year. They really made Russia's grip on Crimea more difficult and managed to even push back the Black Sea fleet from ports in Crimea to Russian ports. And so that's a victory in and of itself.
We are hearing a bit about war weariness going into another winter and with things not exactly ending the year on a high note as far as worrying about the counteroffensive not going as hoped. And of course, bigger concerns about whether the U.S. is going to continue being able to provide support. How are people that you know and you talk to feeling about the setbacks? Are they worried for what could happen without that support? What are you hearing?
Yeah, Ukrainians, of course, are worried. They're also exhausted. You know, for them, this country of roughly 40 million people, this is a war that has not been going on only for the past 2 years. The past 2 years have just seen Russia's war on this all-out massive scale. But war has been waged by Russia against Ukraine now for 10 years. So, you know, Ukrainians have lived with this for a long time. You know, they're exhausted by it. But they don't have the luxury of sort of, you know, just moving on to the next big global conflict or event and being distracted by our American politics or somebody else's election in the EU or the war in Israel and Gaza. They are living with war. They're going to be living with it, they fear, for quite a while now, you know, going ahead. And to put it plainly, they're tired of the discussion around our, in the West, war fatigue. You know, they don't have the luxury of being tired. They have to continue to go out and fight day in and day out. They're losing many of their very best people who have volunteered to fight against Russia. To them, to Ukrainians, this is an existential war. So while they are perhaps not in the highest of spirits this holiday season as they were last year, you know, they know what needs to be done. They know that if they stop fighting, if they stop lobbying for outside support from the West, that could be disastrous. That could lead to a Ukrainian loss, a Russian victory, which would not only be devastating to Ukraine, but also to Europe, to NATO, and I think, you know, to the world writ large.
Christopher Miller, author of The War Came to Us, Life and Death in Ukraine. 2023 was the hottest year on record, and some scientists say it was Earth's hottest in 125,000 years. Across the globe, supercharged temperatures helped drive catastrophic floods, storms, and deadly wildfires.
You gotta go!
The situation is horrific. I saw roads split in half. Homes have been demolished, submerged underwater.
Winds up to 150 miles an hour.
We're seeing much more Category 4, 5 cyclones that used to be once in a generation kind of thing.
U.S. Climate Envoy John Kerry at the December COP28 Climate Summit noted a palpable sense of urgency.
Mother Nature over the past year could not have been more clear with all of us, with the size of the floods and the fires and the changes in nation after nation about what is happening.
Nearly 200 countries agreed to begin reducing global consumption of fossil fuels, but critics like climate activist Greta Thunberg said the deal was not enough to prevent global temperatures from rising to levels scientists say will trigger catastrophic and irreversible impacts.
Some people say that this is a first step, but we've already had first steps and that hasn't led us anywhere. The emissions are still increasing. We are experiencing record highs. This text is toothless and it is nowhere even close to being sufficient to keep us within the 1.5 degree limit.
Extreme weather in 2023 led to thousands of deaths and millions displaced. A recent UNICEF report found millions of children in particular are being driven from their homes by extreme weather events related to climate change. For details, I spoke with Lorena Naus, UNICEF's global chief of migration and displacement.
It was a pretty alarming number that at least 43 million child displacements were linked to extreme weather just in over the past 6 years. It's staggering. Is this number even potentially higher?
The figure that we put forward in the report is indeed shocking in terms of its, you know, sheer size, with an estimate of 43 million children having been displaced by the main extreme weather events that drive displacement, in particular floods, storms, droughts, and wildfires, which breaks down to the 20,000 figure per day of children being displaced and sort of forced from their homes. But it's important that it's clear that these are not refugees. They are internally displaced. So the figure that we estimated really is children who are forced from their homes, but they're staying in their countries. They're just, you know, moving, and including they're being evacuated, they're being forced away. These are not children that have crossed borders. The second answer is yes, it is an absolute underestimate. In some instances, I would say it's possibly even just the tip of an iceberg. I think where the real number is probably most off is on drought-related displacements, and any type of displacements of children that occurs in a context of slow onset impact. So droughts and sort of slow changes that over a period of years erode the livelihood opportunities in communities or just turn certain places for children uninhabitable. And in those countries where this occurs most instantly, you know, Somalia, Horn of Africa, parts of sort of Central Africa, the data situation is the worst. And the attribution is the hardest, because it is often over several years that, you know, it gets harder and harder and harder. And then at some point, children and families just no longer can stay. But the trigger is much harder to sort of to connect to a particular incident. So on droughts, we know that the figures that we have are even probably worse than just the tip of an iceberg. They're just a hint of giving us a sense of how in some countries these figures are huge, like 1.3 million children having been displaced just freshly in Somalia in the last year. Yeah, you know, it's a crazy figure when you're breaking it down. But overall, I think if we were to know the real figures, we would really not sleep at night. And already with 20,000 children being displaced every single day, it should make us very nervous.
What do you expect the trend to be in the coming years and decades?
We asked a few simple questions that have complicated answers. One question was, where have children been displaced by the four key drivers, which are floods, storms, droughts, and wildfires, over the past 6 years? And what does that in a way tell us in terms of the scale and the scope? So that's the overall figure, 43 million, 20,000 almost a day. Really the fact that 95% of those displacements are driven by floods and storms. So that's really the big, big push, but also that the data set on droughts in particular is very, very poor. So it's an underestimate. And then we asked ourselves the question, where are children at most risk of being displaced in the future? And here we're looking, of course, at absolute figures, you know, where is the largest number of children at risk? But also the question we asked is, where is the gap between the numbers, the risk of children of being displaced in the future by any of these extreme weather events, and the capacities of the communities to protect those children? Where is that gap the greatest? So really, where will children be most vulnerable? There's a number of countries where a large number of children will be at risk of displacement or will need to be evacuated. Countries like the Philippines or countries like India and China that actually already have pretty robust early warning systems in place, procedures to not just warn communities, but evacuate and facilitate their speedy return, and to in a way try to minimize the disruptions on children's lives. The countries we're really most concerned about is the countries where the number of children at risk is great, like South Sudan, Somalia, islands in the Pacific or the Caribbean, or Mozambique or Chad, but where there are zero capacities to prepare, to warn, to protect, and children are just literally facing the elements on their own without any support.
Can you elaborate a bit on what the impacts are of being displaced?
Let's assume you are in a rural community, in a community dependent on subsistence agriculture, and a flood washes away your entire livestock, your house, your home, your community, your school. And not just that you lose everything as a family, any possibility to be fed as a child, but you get separated from from your parents. And then, of course, there is also the psychosocial impact on the experience of seeing your communities ripped apart, being separated from your parents of such a catastrophe.
Verena Nals, UNICEF's Global Chief of Migration and Displacement. And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London wishing you a happy and healthy New Year.